The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Pick up with an article from Volume 57, Number 1, the Fall 2017 issue, which is called Carolina Style, What Stories Do Our Clothes Tell? And the article is called, What Do You Think? Why Should We Care About Old Clothes? In this issue, we learn that historians care because clothes and hairstyles help them understand more about people who lived in the past. Now you can do that too. But it's not just old clothes. Your clothes tell stories about your history, too. Your baby clothes show how big you've grown. Maybe you just can't let go of something you once wore because it reminds you of a special day or a special person. And those lucky gym socks, they're as much a keepsake from the big game as the trophy your team brought home. Looking at what people wore is just another tool that historians use to study the past. But there is one thing we try hard not to do, and that's to judge people based on what they wore. Today on social media, many people seem to feel free just to do that, to make fun of someone's hair or clothes, to judge people because they somehow look different, to use language or tweet mean things. But that's a form of bullying, not cool. Historians have a better idea. We look at something new or unexpected or different, or even weird, with curiosity. We ask questions. We want to know more. We hope this issue helps you look at clothing and hair in new ways, but remember, clothes are just the packaging. It's the person inside that really matters. Let's make history by celebrating everyone's freedom to express their own Carolina style in a way that says, this is who I am. And the best way to start your research when you see something new? Just smile. Say hey. And start a brand new conversation. That's from Kathy East, the editor. Here are some captions for the accompanying photographs. Fashions change, but one historical truth stays the same. People love to have fun. These friends' bathing suits from around 1926 may seem a bit funny to us, but smiles and goofing around never go out of style. Another photograph. What's with those odd looking hats, and why are these girls sitting in trunks? Inquiring historians want to know, how would you begin your investigation? And then the third photograph, whoa, North Carolinian Sam Brinkley, born in 1850 and died in 1929, became famous for having one of the world's longest beards. He was 6'2", and his beard grew to be 5'4". Brinkley was born near Burnsville in Yancey County. He traveled with the Barnum & Bailey Circus and became known as an expert on beards. Read more about Brinkley and other Tar Heels on the blog This Day in North Carolina History at www.ncdcr.gov/blogs/this-day-in-north-carolina-history. And now for a couple of articles from the Spring 2010 edition of the Tar Heel Junior Historian, which is about the Great Depression. The first one is Walking Out, the Great Textile Strike of 1934 by B.J. Davis, the chief of the Education Division at the North Carolina Museum of History at that time. In the 1920s, North Carolina ranked as the largest producer of textiles in the United States. Throughout the South, low wages and good access to electricity had led companies to build a large number of factories, or mills, that made yarn, wove fabric, and spun cotton. Thousands of Tar Heels worked in mills, especially in the Piedmont region. Most of these workers faced long hours and low wages, and many felt unhappy about their working conditions. Others were too scared of losing their jobs to complain. By the early 1930s, nearly one out of four North Carolinians had no job. As many people struggled to keep their homes and find enough to eat, textile workers were pulling together, hoping that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt would find a way to help them. On Saturday, September 1st, 1934, in its afternoon edition, the Gastonia Daily Gazette newspaper made a special request to Gaston County citizens to use discretion. The request read, "The Gazette would like to make an earnest plea to all concerned in the proposed textile strike that we exercise caution and care in this county." It continued, "We do not want a repetition of the 1929 troubles. Goodness knows this county and city received too much unfavorable publicity from that summer. We've not been able to live it down for 5 years." The troubles mentioned in the newspaper involved a strike in June 1929 at the Lauray Mill in Gastonia. During a strike, employees temporarily stop working or walk off their jobs to bring attention to work-related demands or to protest. In 1929, Lauray workers grew so unhappy that they organized a strike to demand more pay, a 40-hour work week, and better working conditions. Violence broke out between those who supported the strike and those who did not. On September 14, 1929, a carload of armed men attacked a group of strikers traveling to a rally. One of the strike organizers, Ella Mae Wiggins, was killed. Even at that time, strikes were not uncommon in southern textile mills. Most workers labored 55 to 60 hours 6 days a week and earned less than $10 a week in difficult environments. The machines that spun yarn, wove fabric, and provided materials for the clothing industry were loud and dangerous to work around. When workers inhaled small pieces of fabric that filled the air and stuck to their clothes, they could suffer breathing problems and lung damage. Whole families, including children, worked in the mills. This aspect changed by the 1930s. The stretch-out and heavier work demands led to mostly older teens and adults working. The stretch-out caused hard feelings between mill owners and workers. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, mill owners had begun trying something called scientific management. The idea got its start in the late 1890s with an engineer named Frederick Winslow Taylor, and later the husband and wife team of Frank B. and Lillian M. Gilbreth. Taylor claimed he had figured out how companies could save huge sums of money by carefully observing workers and revising the way they did their jobs. He said the methods could lead to the same number of workers doing more work in less time. The theory behind Taylor's claim was that making workers more efficient would lead to shorter work days and higher wages for employees, as well as higher profits for their employers. In reality, scientific management gave mill owners more ways to reduce expenses by cutting jobs and having fewer employees do more work. Mill owners replaced people with newer and more advanced machines, requiring remaining workers to cover or operate more machinery. Wages did not go up, and hours did not go down. The mill workers called this new management technique the stretch-out, since they felt it stretched them to their limits. They did not like outsiders coming to the mills, timing their every move, including breaks with stopwatches. They felt like they were being treated like machines themselves. When President Roosevelt took office in 1933, the country was struggling with the Great Depression. Textile workers across the United States hoped for an administration that would help put people back to work and protect their jobs from further cuts. They also hoped that the new government would help workers organize into groups or unions. Unions could negotiate with mill workers as a group to resolve complaints and issues like the dreaded stretch-out. On June 16, 1933, Roosevelt signed the National Industrial Recovery Act, NIRA, into law. The law was designed to help American companies be more competitive, to provide new jobs and protect existing jobs. The NIRA guaranteed the right to join unions and engage in collective bargaining. It also required companies to set limits on hours worked each day, 8, and determine the lowest starting wage paid per week, around $12 in textile mills. Although workers, employers, and unions praised the new law at first, it soon became clear that it benefited mill owners in several ways. Workers and union representatives quickly became frustrated with layers of time-consuming and difficult paperwork and procedures required under the new law. Despite these difficulties, under the protection of the new law, union membership skyrocketed. Workers established local chapters of a union where they lived, holding meetings, electing officers, and discussing important issues. Many new locals sprang up across the South in places like Charlotte and Gastonia. That spring, tensions between mill owners and workers ran high. Many owners threatened workers who joined unions and fired union representatives and organizers. Even before 1934, workers who joined unions or participated in strikes sometimes got fired and forced out of their mill village homes. Wages remained low, the stretch out was still common, and some mills refused to negotiate with or recognize any union representation. In July 1934, frustrated workers in Alabama became unwilling to wait for the National United Textile Workers, the UTW, union to call a strike. They staged a walkout. Francis Gorman, the UTW's vice president, soon called for a nationwide strike to start on September 1st. On Monday, September 3rd, textile workers in Gastonia held the city's first Labor Day parade through the center of town. Newspapers reported that 10,000 people participated. During the next week, thousands of union members traveled throughout the South in cars and trucks to organize workers and help close down mills. People called these fleets of union supporters flying squadrons. By week's end, 300,000 to 500,000 textile workers from New England to the Deep South had gone on strike. Most strikers came from the cotton mills of North and South Carolina. All 104 mills in Gaston County had closed by September 7th. On Saturday, September 8th, the headline of the Gastonia Daily Gazette called out, "Union leaders dare mill owners to start Monday." However, mill owners, especially those in the South, had learned their lessons from prior strikes. Many hired private guards and got help from state and local law enforcement agencies and even National Guard members. Many sheriffs quickly added large numbers of additional deputies whose only qualification was carrying a gun. This protection of the mills made it possible for some workers to cross the strike's picket lines and keep the mills open. It also increased the chance for violence. In Kannapolis, where the Cannon Mills were located, 1,200 strikers confronted two military companies and an additional 99 sheriff's deputies armed with shotguns. Although no one died in North Carolina, on September 6th, six picketers had been shot to death and more than 20 others wounded in Honea Path, South Carolina. Rhode Island and Georgia officials also reported deaths. Georgia Governor Eugene Talmadge grew so angry that he declared martial law, ordering 4,000 National Guardsmen to help maintain order and prevent picketing. The growing violence forced President Roosevelt to get involved. He put together a small board chaired by John Wynant, former governor of New Hampshire, to try to end the strike by resolving differences between the union and the mills. On September 18th, the Wynant board released its recommendations. This report, although showing some sympathy for the strikers, made no recommendations that would have raised wages, improved working conditions, or changed the stretch out. It marked a clear victory for the mill owners. UTW leaders, unwilling to accept defeat, called the strike a success. They ordered union members back to work. Strikers in the North, where state laws protecting workers were stronger and unions were better organized and more powerful, did see some improvements. Workers in the South faced a bitter and unfriendly turn. The strike of 1934 had offered Southern textile workers the short-lived hope of organized bargaining with their employers and national recognition for their struggles. Many workers felt that, between the hollow promises they received from the federal government and the lack of support from the textile union, union membership was not that important. Textile unions would never recover from such a devastating defeat. Today, the textile industry that once held such importance in North Carolina is nearly gone. Many of the same struggles and issues that faced textile workers in the 1930s continue. Only now, the challenges arise in textile mills in faraway places like China, Honduras, Cambodia, Laos, and Sri Lanka. There are three additional inserts accompanying this article. The first one is, what was that word? These are definitions of terms. Collective bargaining is negotiations between workers' groups or unions with employers to resolve conflict or to determine issues such as wages, hours, rules, and working conditions. Martial law is the temporary enforcement of a rule of law and public safety by military authorities on a civilian population. A mill village is a collection of homes, stores, and other buildings provided by many mill owners during the 1800s and early 1900s that supplied housing and various services to mill workers. A picket line is a line, grouping, or procession of people at a work site staging a protest. Scientific management is the theory of using scientific methods of observation and calculations to analyze how a particular task is done, with the goal of making the task faster and increasing the capacity or amount of work done. Stretch out is the name for the management practice of reducing positions while requiring remaining workers to take on more work or responsibilities without any increase in pay. Union is an organization that represents a certain group or groups of workers that is responsible for monitoring working conditions and negotiating with the employer to improve conditions and benefits provided to employees. And a walkout is a group's refusal to work as a sign of protest, a labor strike. And the other two inserts are letters to the governor at the time, J.C.B. Eringhouse. The first one is from A.F. Reinhart, the sheriff of Lincoln County, written September 5th, 1934. Early this morning, another mob of out-of-county strikers appeared at the XL mill in the town of Lincolnton with the announced purpose of closing it down. The management, however, had already closed the mill, and the mob headed toward Cabarrus County, according to my information, bent on joining other delegations en route for the purpose of closing down the Cannon Mills. We need help to avoid destruction of property and violence. I do not think the Lincoln County mills can be opened without the intervention of troops. And the second letter, it was from Mrs. L.H. Anderson of Statesville, written September 15, 1934. I am a textile worker. I do not favor strikes, but I do think that it's time for something to be done. The poor working class of people have been imposed on too much already. I am glad that we have a president that is trying to do something to help the working class of people, but I do not think many manufacturers are doing what the National Recovery Administration is intended for. They make the people do the same amount of work in 8 hours that they did before in 10. I work here in a mill that manufactures men and boys' socks and anklets, and we are compelled to get out so much in 8 hours to make production per day. We must do that amount to get $2.40 per day, else lose our jobs. Sometimes people work 9.5 hours and get paid 8 hours. Those of us with children cannot sign the paper in favor of a strike. If you complain, you lose your job. We need the money, but we are being worked too hard. The second article is Depression Voices: Lessons from Our Elders, collected by Robin Egger. Some years before this issue in 2010, Robin Egger was commissioned to direct a project called Personal Legacies, Surviving the Great Depression, which resulted in an exhibit at the Charlotte Museum of History, a PBS documentary, and a book published in 2006. She interviewed about 100 people ages 85 to 103 who had lived in the Charlotte area between 1929 and 1939, learning about their experiences and their advice for surviving tough times. These are excerpts from the book. Access www.robinegger.com to learn more. Katie Stewart Greer, Steele County, Steel Creek community. I didn't know I was poor because we lived on a farm and we always had food. My dad was a smart old man. He raised most of the food for the family and saved money, so he did not owe much to the farmer we sharecropped for. We had cows for milk and a churn for making butter. We also had chickens and two hogs to raise pigs to sell. All we had to buy in the store was salt, sugar, and soda for baking. One year, the boll weevils ate the cotton that we had planted, so we did not get any money, and we ate peas, because that's all we had. Jesse Atkins of Charlotte. Atkins was 3 months old in 1928 when his father left. His mother took a job as a spinner at Charlotte's Highland Park Mill, and they moved to a four-room mill house nearby. Jesse's grandmother watched him while his mother worked from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. for about $7 a week. My mother was Irish, and her mother insisted that there was always a place for family to stay. Grandmother helped people in the neighborhood, too. They brought her cabbages for the community sauerkraut pot, a big wooden barrel with a board on the top and a rock to keep it down. She used to do wash for people in the wash pot in the backyard, boiling the clothes that she stirred with a big paddle. She also fed anybody who came by hungry. We had hobos come to the door from Bum Woods on the corner of Yadkin Avenue. Those hobos made some of the best stew you ever had in your life. Us kids were not supposed to go there, but we did. I went to school at North Charlotte Primary from first to third grade. It was a four-room school set off of North Davidson Street behind Spencer Memorial United Methodist Church, which is long gone. There were three classrooms and an auditorium. Most mill kids went to Tech High, where the kids had wood shop, mechanical drawing, and auto mechanics. The girls had home economics. After school, we went to East 36th Street to the park, which was where the Red Shield Boys Club was run by the Salvation Army. It was a big building that had a gym and a swimming pool. The mill villages were segregated, so we went to our own schools. But when school was over, no one knew the difference. We were just kids. Families were mostly Scotch-Irish and African-American. It really wasn't a bad life. I had a wonderful time. It was all I knew. We didn't know we were poor because everybody else was in the same boat. Nobody had any more than anyone else in the mill village. In the summertime, kids in the neighborhood knew what everyone was having for lunch, and we could go to each other's houses. For entertainment, we went to movies. Walking 3 miles to town along the railroad tracks, we would stop by Cress's on the way to pick up a 5-cent bag of popcorn. I carried the Charlotte News for about 3 weeks for 25 cents a week to get enough to go to the movies. Then I delivered people's groceries from Barrett's grocery store across the street. You could charge your groceries, have it taken out of your check, or pay for it. Mother paid for everything she got. She did not believe in charging anything if she could get out of it. She bought coal through the mill in the wintertime, and the mill took it out of her salary. She remarried, but my stepfather got fired for union participation, so we moved a half a block away from the mill village to 35th Street in 1939. We went from wooden floors to linoleum and thought we were really going up in the world. We also had a hot water heater that you fired up on Saturdays. The bathroom was on the back porch, and we had a heater that you could fill with a bucket of coal in it at night, and it was still warm in the morning. We raised a lot of food. We had a garden and chickens. We survived because the mill village was a community of love. There was no getting by with anything. Teachers called your parents at work if you messed up. If you were at someone else's house and did something, they would correct you and then tell your parents. You learned to be self-sufficient as best you could and to have moral values. DeWitt Reed from Biddeville Community. There were no paved roads in the black communities except Mill Road in the Biddeville section. Black families lived in the wards that were built around the city so that they could walk to work. Even though the buses cost only 7 cents, they did not come through the black community. Gas was about 16 cents a gallon, and taxis only charged 10 cents to go to town. Very few blacks were employed during the Depression. My dad worked for an invalid. Mom worked as a domestic. My family lived in a shotgun house, and we shared an outhouse with four other families. Nobody ever went hungry because we could pick creasy greens, similar to watercress, by the creek banks, and poke salad, pokeweed, by the mine hill. Mama made fatback gravy out of salt pork and used fish heads to make stew. We walked to Merida Bakery on West Trade Street to get week-old bread and ate it, mold and all. When people were desperate for heat in the winter, they would walk along the railroad tracks looking for pieces of coal that fell off the cars. Boards that fell off an empty house were used for firewood. When the WPA came up to clean an area, people would take wood from their piles or rummage from wood in the garbage dump on the west side of town. I was the oldest with one brother and one sister, and I worked before I was 10 years old to help out my family. My first job was delivering handbills door-to-door from stores like Sears, JCPenney's, and Belk's, and from food stores like Big Star, A&P, and Colonial. I made 35 cents an hour. When I was 10 years old, I started to shine shoes on the street until they required $1 a year for a license. After that, I just left my shoe shine kit by the corner at the fire station, and the firemen would use my stuff and leave me money. I built a wooden wagon with discarded wheels from the mills and went all over town looking for copper and aluminum to sell for 5 cents a pound at the Schwartz junkyard where the stadium is now. Ann Malden Elliott of Charlotte. People would come to the back door for food. They drew a kind lady sign at our home with a silhouette of a cat to tell others who came to our back door that they would get food there. We were not rich in money, but we were rich in family. I was one of five children, and my family was very close. My mother's sister lived with us for a year, and we had to tighten our belts. I remember when Sloppy Joe sweaters, which came down to the knees, were in style, and I asked my mother for one. I was so disappointed when she said, "Ann, you already have a sweater." We used to love eating moose, but we cut down on luxuries like cream during the Depression. For a while, we had a Hudson and a Terraplane, but we had to go to one car. And on the very back page, there are photographs with faces of the Great Depression. During the Great Depression, Federal Farm Security Administration photographers took more than 2,000 photographs across North Carolina, and these are a few of them, including women at Wheelie's Church near Gordonton for annual grounds cleanup day, a tenant farmer in Chatham County in 1939, farmer Fagan Jones and family of Zebulon, 10-year-old son of a tobacco sharecropper in Granville County, Mr. Whitfield, tobacco sharecropper with baby on front porch in Person County, female migrant worker waiting to leave Bellcross for a new job in Virginia, and daughter of Nat Williamson in Guilford County, and a son of a tenant farmer. We've run out of time for today's episode of Independent Living. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any comments, concerns, or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time.